This is the continuation of session 3.
Okay. One last question, then we're going to talk about.
How does this fit in with the degenerate age and the fact that all the teaching is going to disappear and there won't be any?
She said, what about the thing at the diamond cutter or in the Abhidharma at the end where it says, look, the teachings are going to die, you know?
So there won't be teachers for us.
Yeah. Or there won't be any teachers around. This is referring to people who are still stuck in this version of the desire realm, okay? On this planet. So yeah, the teachings will die on this planet. And they will die because the karma of the people to have them will die. See, that's another dirty karma, dirty good karma, and it wears out. So then as the karma of the people wears out, those people who haven't become Aryas and Arhats, that haven't practiced well, then their karma to have... you can see His Holiness is getting old, so we're getting our own version of this now. You know, the karma to have a Dalai Lama who's adult and who's alive in my world while I'm on the world is ending, you know, and there's a chance, it seems like, that we could be later in our lives not have an adult Dalai Lama around to give us teachings and things like that. The karma to have His Holiness in the world is wearing out. Or each of our individual karma to be able to experience a Dalai Lama in this world is wearing out, and he appears to be getting older. And that's very expensive karma, you know, to maintain that person in your life is very difficult. It takes a lot of... That's why you have to be so careful about our lamas, you know. Not like me, I'm very bad about it. Okay. Then we'll be doing a 3 retreat starting in March 2000, and not much to say, it's just a 3-year retreat. In New York, there will continue, I have 12 student teachers there who are doing half the course load now. Half of every class is taught by student teachers. And they'll be continuing, cycling through the 15 courses, actually it'll be 18 courses by then, in the next 3 years. So, you know, there'll be good people who have been through 7 years of training leading the courses, and there'll be smaller courses like 10 or 15, 20 people, and maybe 3 or 4 going on at a time, so you can catch all the subjects you didn't catch before, and there'll be correspondence courses continue to be sent out, and we keep trying to clean them up. The first 3 I think are rough on the audio because we didn't know we were going to make correspondence courses. Those were like little cheap tape recorders back next to the dog. And we say this dog did a great thing because this guy was on a plane and Richard Gere sat next to him and he was doing some course 1 or something and Richard Gere said, let me hear, and there was this noise and dogs but he really liked it, and so he came over one day and said, I'll pay for some of your stuff, you know. And so we're thinking the dog did a great job. And then during the 3-year retreat, there'll be 3-week classes twice a year. Okay, so I'll conduct 3-week classes twice a year.
Well, how will we find out when those are?
The dates are already fixed, and you can talk to Winston. But I think basically December, trying to cover the Christmas holiday period, and June.
May into June.
Late May, early June, and then late December, early January. Or, you know, so that we're trying to catch people when their kids are not in school. And the idea out there is that we are negotiating the purchase of we tried to get a free 5 acres, and then we tried to get a free half acre, and then the guy wanted us to buy 40 acres, and then finally they said, look, take 9,000 acres and we'll give it to you really cheap. And so I'm like, I don't have $5. I literally don't have $50. So, you know, this is kind of silly to talk to me about this. And then a couple of sponsors came up and said, maybe it's interesting, you should think about it. You know, like, you could do something interesting there and think about it. And then I started thinking and I said... And then we came out with an idea of basically, it's like a rectangle of land and that we could on once... It's backed up to a national park, a mountain, this huge mountain range. Where Cochise used to hang out, and that whole corner we're thinking to make long-term retreat area for people to do from like 1 month to 3-year retreats, and it's of the size that you wouldn't have to see anyone else. Like, the building could be actually out of sight from other buildings. It's a and it's high desert, meaning it's sunny all the time, but it's not too hot and not too cold. It's 4,800. So it's very moderate all year. It's between 50 and 80 degrees most of the year, and which is perfect for meditation. And it's totally, totally, totally silent. There's nothing. The nearest good grocery store is an hour and a half away. And so from that point of view, it's totally silent. And so we're negotiating. Winston's working on that. He's the manager of that project. And it looks pretty good for... We're going to try to acquire the land in 10 years gradually. And we have some nice sponsors who are helping, and if you can help, it'd be nice, if you're interested in it. So it'd be one part for long-term meditation. Then we'd like to build a university along the Mongolian lines of doing these things. In Mongolia, when you finished your geshe, you went to medical school and became a Tibetan doctor. And after you finished that, you went on to dance, sacred dance school, and became a dancer. And then you learned sculpture, and learn to make holy images, like, and then, you know, Sanskrit, and then Tantra, and we'd like to do that model again. We'd like to revive that model. And in Mongolia, they're trying, but the trained teachers are mostly dead. But we've been talking to like dance masters in Mongolia and Tibet, and all kinds of, our idea is to have elderly masters come, offer them a good place to stay and healthcare, and then have a university where you can study for free. But you have to commit to become a master. So you have to commit to 5 to 10 years of intense study, but it's free. And it's led by a true master of that art. So whether it's dance or architecture or sculpture or painting or music or ritual, or philosophy, yeah. No, there'd be a whole school of ritual for mandalas, satsas, everything else. But it would be, the idea is to get someone who's the best in the world to teach it and offer them a nice position and health care and things like that. That seems to be like, a lot of the great lamas from my monastery in India are leaving to get medical care in Singapore and never coming back. And we'd like to just push them a little farther to Arizona. And, you know what I mean? And then guarantee them some kind of security there. And then the thing is, when they get old, they want to pass it on. You see, I mean, when you're like 50 and you're all cocky and you're a geshe, you're not like so interested in the tradition or the lineage. But when you're 70, you start to think in terms of who's going to pass it on, you know? So we've been talking to them, and there's a lot of people interested to come. And we'd like to build a university there. And that would be the theory of it, that you would commit to study and master something and not dabble in it, you know, not dabble in Tibetan medicine for 6 weeks or something, but take the 6 years it takes to become a real Tibetan doctor and then put out 10 Tibetan doctors or 50 Tibetan doctors, Americans. My next dream is that the Americans help to define the American form of that art. So like, American tanka, after you've mastered Tibetan tanka painting for 7-8 years, then you help us define an American tanka painting, you know. And after you've studied sacred dance seriously for 5 or 6 years, then you help to develop the American forms of those things. Because it'll either happen that way or it'll happen hodgepodge, you know. And I'd like to see it happen. And then the ones who are in the school of philosophy will start writing American commentaries to the great scriptures. People in Tibetan monasteries, they don't study the Sanskrit things anymore. Forget it. I bought the only tengyur in South India to give them. They didn't have one because they study their own commentaries. And to me, it's manifest destiny that there will be American commentaries, American tankas, American sacred dance, art, music, mandalas, and they might as well be done by people who are highly trained in the last version. You see what I mean? So that'll be the function of that university. And it'll start with one little modest building, and it's designed over 25 years to grow into eight colleges in a circle. And yeah.
Geshe-la, two questions.
Yeah.
When do you envision the first part of the project of people being able to go there to study?
As far as study, as far as meditation, I see that if you if you wanted to come as it opens in March or April, if you had any way to help support yourself, because I don't have funding for that, but if you had any way to help support yourself, that the housing we've developed with the help of a lot of great architects like Salim Lee, who's on the board of FPMT, and who's a great architect, and he's helped us design buildings that are quiet, adobe structures that are very cheap, and so we designed a bunch of structures like that, that you just the blueprints, you just get the blueprints, and you build one. And my idea is you could either timeshare with other people, or you could build one for yourself or something. But there are a lot of people who are interested in going, and interested in starting with the meditation. And then the first college opening, I think, we scheduled for the end of the three-year retreat, so that the building would be open upon the end of the three-year retreat, and we'd start philosophical studies there. The thing in New York has been that I've taught more general classes and been unable to teach more in-depth classes. And what I'd like to do at that place is that you sign on for 5 to 10 years, and you can study there for free. But you have to work hard, and you have to come out a master of that thing, whether it's dance or art or whatever you're attracted to. And I think all of them are good for a person who's trying to reach enlightenment. You know, I think, for example, dance is very good for Dzogrim. And I'm not thinking it's irrelevant. It has a deep connection to tantric practice, if it's done properly, and that we would train people how to do it seriously there. So I'd say talk to Winston.
Okay.
He's going to be building. It really depends, frankly, on finances. And we're doing very well. I mean, we were a little scared by the size of it. But people have come forth, and it looks like we can do it. But we still, to open the college depends on how fast we can build the first building and things like
that.
Where in Arizona is it? It's a very cool location in this sense. It's about an hour from Tucson International Airport. And it's in a totally empty area. It's totally empty. The U.S. Army has a secret listening base there for the whole world, because there's no electronic garbage in the air. It's just totally empty. The place is totally, right now it's totally empty. The last part of the Arizona thing, the third part of the property, the concept is large home sites where people could build their own place. And I kind of feel that the future of Buddhism in this country, on a large scale, is lay people like yourself. You know what I mean? I think the percentage of ordained people will be similar to what it is in this room. And that America will be one of the first Buddhist countries, maybe the first, where the mass of lay people are well trained in Buddhism. And it's not just the thing of sacred priests who have the information and are holding it, you know, that I think America, like in its political structure, will be dharmically the same way, and that Dharma will be spread out among the lay people, and normal lay people will be highly trained in Buddhism and Tantra and everything else. And I think it's going to be the way it's going to be. And I don't see Americans on the whole attracted to a very rigid structure like in a more structured monastery or something like that. I see Americans probably more succeeding in their own home, like having their own home site. So the concept is that you would have 5 or 10 acres, like a lot of space, and you'd be far away from the nearest person, and you'd have a quiet little adobe place, and you could live there, and you could practice there. And I think it's more likely to happen like that. And maybe live with 3 or 4 other people that you feel close to, or, you know, or something like that. So that the third part of that property is, the reason it's so big, and it's big, it's like 5 miles by 5 miles or something, is that you could practice your tantric meditations, you know, quietly by yourself, you know, in your home, and still be within walking distance of some good teachers, some really good teachers, you know, some real masters. And then as far as livelihood, there's two approaches there. One is there are people living there now who are Buddhists who are living off $150 a month, you know, because there's no heating, there's no cooling, all the electricity is solar and free. And the water is, there's these they've had for hundred years these water well, you know, what do you call them? Windmills. And they just pump it up. Nobody around there has an electrical water pump or anything. They just come up. And so you don't have any, you don't have an electrical bill. You're not even on the grid. See what I mean? You don't even have a wire going to your house. You don't have water. You have water. You have heat. You don't need heating. You don't need cooling. And the adobe is very quiet and very cheap. And our idea is that make it cheap and live cheap. And then my intention is to, so I think, and there's also by coincidence a very, very sophisticated optic line is coming through that property. It's one of the properties that was selected for a nationwide web thing, you know, and there's going to be this huge web. It's already being laid. I think that commerce is going to change in the next 5 to 10 years, and most objects will be sold on the web, and most people will work a lot on the web. And personally, my immediate group of students, we do everything on the web. We don't have an office. We don't have a location. We're in the airport, or we're at Raleigh, or we're in LA, or it doesn't matter. We get paid to do, we get grants from various people to do different kinds of scholarship or different kinds of activities, and we don't have an office. And I think it's going to be that way. So I think more and more people, you don't have to really, the reason to live in a city becomes much less in future years, I think. I think that kind of place will become very popular. I think people will start to spread out more, because you can get everything you need by ordering it. I don't think a record store will exist in 10 years. It'll just be on the web and you'll get it. You know, there'll be a lot more coffee shops because people will miss each other. You know, you still need that experience. But anyway, there's a village being built nearby which is very high-tech and very quiet, ecologically responsible village is being built about 2 miles north of us by a very beautiful man. So there'll be a place for like that. But my concept is that. And I still intend to be back in New York like half the year and traveling half the year to teach, because I can't see, it's not for everybody. Until you get older, I still will have other kinds of courses there. But what I mean is, I think that especially in New York, especially where we are in New York, is still a great place to meet new students and meet talented new people. And I think the main stops on that we're going to now, we'd still continue to do that. So that's my spiel. Yeah. Right now we don't have much money for that. So I think we started you could talk to Aura, but it'd be very nice if you could send cheerio money and stuff. And I've never asked my students for money, but I think this is important, and I think the place is important. And I ask you this, I don't believe anybody in this room has much money. But if you know anybody who we could approach and we could do all the work, you know, somebody who might think that saving Tibetan books was important or something, or somebody who thinks that bringing that cultural thing here would be important. We've been very successful in meeting friends of friends. Like, we've gotten literally 2 very large grants from friends of friends, you know, and somebody knew a rich person who kind of likes Tibet.
How about David Blum in San Francisco?
Give her his number. But anyway, anything like that would be appreciated. Yeah, yeah, stuff like that. So if you know, put your brain to it, it's important that it happens. What it'll mean is whether Buddhism is introduced into America in an organized way or in a disorganized way, you know. And I think it's very beautiful if it happens that way. And just think about it. I'm not asking that you support it directly, because I don't want to taint my teachings by asking for money. But if you know anybody, or if anything comes to your mind, then really think, because a couple of people come to us with kind of wacky ideas and they worked, you know. So if they don't include selling T-shirts and stuff, okay, right, stuff like that. Lastly, do you have that CD thing? We have a book that you can look through, a picture book of this proposal for the place. It's called Dragoon Mountain. That place is called Dragoon Mountain. It's surrounded on most of the sides by national or state forests, and so that makes it kind of cool too. There'll be a 3-mile buffer around the place, basically.
What's the name of it?
The mountain is called Dragoon, like Dragoon meaning a soldier. And that's where the U.S. cavalry used to try to chase Cochise for 40 years. And that mountain has caves peppered all over it with springs in them. The Indians, the Apaches, lived there for 40 years and avoided the entire U.S. Army. And it's great. So my idea is, like, you know, if we don't get the money for the building, we'll just go out in the caves, you know. And the Park Service can try to find us, you know. And the Park Service has been very sweet. They say, you know, we're right on the border, so... They say you can even have your teachings in these natural amphitheaters where the Indians used to have their... There's prehistoric drawings on the rocks, and they said, sure, go ahead and use it. And they said, there's a problem with the road. And we said, yeah, what? And they said, we'll have to widen it for you, so just give us warning, you know. And it's like that. They're very cool. So the teachings will probably be in some place like that. Okay. And you're welcome to come out and... And Winston's in charge of that whole project. So if you have any ideas or any kind of... You want to
stay a little bit after.
Yeah. If you want to hang out with Winston while you're eating and talk about it. This is the time... I think it's a very seminal point in American Buddhist history. I think if it goes well, lots of incredible things could happen. So think about it. You know, you could be in on the beginning. Okay. This is something we'd like to present to Kadampa Center. Okay. Don Brown. That's our new CD. And it's 5 years of intense work by most of the people from New York who are here have contributed in some way. And there's hundreds of Tibetan refugees getting paid to put in their scriptures. There's about... we finished about 150,000 pages now. We are about 3% finished. Okay? It'll take about 150 years to finish. But all the books are on the web for free. So it's about 1,000 books on this CD of ancient scriptures, and all organized by Aura helped with that, Christy helped with that, into categories. So like if you want to do, I met who's the Rinpoche, Rilpo Rinpoche's attendant, and they said, "Do you have a Guhya Samaja?" You know, sadhana, but not too long and short, and it's got to have this little thing in it. Do you have one of those? So you like click on Guhya Samaja, then you click on sadhana, and then you pick out of 10 sadhanas, you pick the shortest one, and then you search for this section, and it has it. And then I just gave it to him in about 10 minutes, and he was so happy, you know. So it's set up that way, it's designed that way. And yeah. To translate it will take about... the Tibetans took 700 years, but we have computers. Aura is working on an English version. We're working very hard on an English version. So if you're... For that, we need lots of people who can transcribe tapes, because we've covered most of the subjects on the CD. And we're trying to do that in English and make it into a database. So like if you don't remember the order of the water bowls, you go on the web, you click water bowl. No, you just search for water bowl, order... And it tells you, start from left to right, and here's the thing you do. And that's our hope, is that she's working on that. So we got a nice grant to start. We still need help. We still need volunteers for that. She's finished a couple thousand pages.
People have transcribed over 100 tapes, and there's hundreds more. But the idea is that us at the very, you know, before Yeshua's long retreat, that there'd be a place on the web where you have access to all of the translations he's ever done, transcriptions of all of the lectures, like a whole sort of database of any, you know, anything that we've produced as material. If you could listen to them online, you could have little video clips, you could print out, you know, homework studying for class 6. And we do need a lot of help for people who can type or if you can edit. And not in this break, but in maybe one of the breaks tomorrow, I can talk to anybody who's interested in helping with that.
There's a catalog of all the books on the CD. There's 2,700 books finished. The tantric ones are not on the CD. That's why it says 1,000. And we give them to people who can demonstrate that they've had an initiation. But we have a custom. I'm going to pass it around. You close your eyes. You open it up to the back. Second half, you point to something. This is long. This is very cool. And you just see what book you get, you see. Mine is response to a question on the statement by Lord Buddha that those who die and migrate from the lower realms to the higher realms are no more than the motes of dust on his fingertip compared to the motes of dust in the entire planet. You see, people ask me about euthanasia. And they say, is it okay to kill somebody? And I say, but Lord Buddha said the odds of this person going up are equal to the dust particles on his finger compared to the mass of dust particles on the planet. And then there's a question, there's a book about it, is he literal or is he just being figurative? And they say, no, he's being literal. Okay? So it doesn't make sense to kill somebody. You're not helping them. You see what I mean? But anyway, that's the kind of stuff. So you go through, take it, and I'd like to leave it here on your altar, maybe. Okay, Don? And okay, cool. Okay, we'll do a prayer. You ready?
This is the end of session 3. Session 4. We reached now the second major principle behind death meditation. So the first one was that you must die. And then that had three parts. And personally, I have trouble remembering them. Like there's 9 rationales for death meditation. And I did it for even a month at a time in retreat, and I still can't remember them. But so if you visualize it as this building and with all those things, it's kind of much easier. So, okay, there's this big dog. And that's can't stop death. And then there's this hourglass, which is clear. That's death is leaking away life is leaking away as we speak. And then third one, you know, you're running down the hallway and you don't have time to look at anything. And that's like, you know, even when you are alive, you don't have time to study. You'll die without having had time to do your practice. Okay? And those are the three meditations, the three lam rims within the lam rim called death is certain. Okay? And now we're going to reach the second one, which is what? The timing is not certain. Okay, the timing is not sure. All right, and again, there'll be 3 rationales for that. Okay, and later we'll connect it to a scene in the visualization, and you'll be able to remember it. This, if you maintain it, like meditate on it the first week every day, and then after that, like every few days, you won't forget the rooms, And like you'll come across this dog and you say, what's this dog for, you know? And then you'll remember after a while. You see what I mean? And it's a good way to, otherwise to just flat memorize the Lam Rim is a little hard. And after you do it, you forget it. So, okay. So here's the first one. For those of you who can't see, it's a Zamling, D-Z-A-M-L-I-N-G, Tse La, T-S-E, L-A, Ngepa, N-G-E-P-A, Me, M-E. Okay? Say Zamling, Tse La, Ngepa, Me. Okay. Zamling is the name in Tibetan for our world, our continent. There's supposed to be four continents around a central mountain called Meru. And we're in the southern continent called Zambuling, which is the land of Zambu, the continent of Zambu. And it's named Zambu because there's this big tree that grows at the side of the ocean, and when the fruits drop off and drop in the water, they go, Zambup. And, okay. Really? Okay. So Zambuling means in our world, in our current reality, in our current plane of reality. Tse means your lifetime, okay, the time of life, lifespan in this case. La, it has no ngepa. Ngepa means fixed number of years, okay? So, this is a mayingak. What's a mayingak?
A non-affirming.
Yeah, it's a logic word. It means by saying that there's no certainty in this realm, what are you saying?
There is certainty
in other realms, okay? So there are. Think of reality as a broad spectrum, like the light spectrum, you know? Think of it as all kinds of different light, like ultraviolet. What's the other ones? I don't know.
Infrared,
and everything in between, all the colors. And then there's X-rays, and then there's ultraviolet rays. I mean, all these kinds of things. And think of the level that you're on as one little slice out of the spectrum. And we are... Reality is like that. There's thousands of other realities going on parallel to this one. We are one. I had a friend who said, don't be so parochial. You know, don't think your reality is the only possible one. You know, Raleigh, Durham, North Carolina, you know, is that the only possible reality going on right now? I mean, we tend to think so, right? But think of that there are thousands of realities going on as we speak at different levels of reality. To get there, how do you get there? How do you get to a different one? Your mind shifts slightly. You see what I mean? It's not like you got to get into a special bus and go certain... You see what I mean? Shambhala isn't in a separate place. It's just a different perception. You see what I mean? So you could go to any one of those levels in the next 10 minutes. You see what I mean? But on this particular... In this particular slice of the reality spectrum... Life is not fixed. On some splice, at other places it is, 500 years, for example. Okay, but in the world that we're living, there is no fixed lifespan. And this thing about average life expectancy is very, very evil and bad for death meditators. Seriously, very bad. Try to get it out of your mind. It'll be hard. Okay, they by drawing an average. They have cheated you into thinking you're going to live that long, and it's not true. You got to clean that one out of your head. It's just not true. Okay, there is no average life expectancy for any single case. You see what I mean? Forget statistics. You're one person. You could die anytime. You see what I mean? It's irrelevant for you. Yeah. Yeah. Zamling means this continent, or meaning this slice of reality. Tse means lifespan. And La Ngepa Me means there is no fixed number of years. Okay, so statistically speaking, yes, it's true. Average is 72 years or something. Individually speaking, you're in trouble. You see, I mean, individually speaking, nobody can tell you how long you're going to live, and nobody can even give you an indication of how long you're going to live. It's random. It's crazy. It's not just. You know, good people die young. Slobs die old, you know. It's unpredictable. It's totally unpredictable. You can't forget when you get to this. Where should we put on the? I think we'll put an average life expectancy notebook in a dead man's hand or something. But
1.2 children.
Yeah. Anyway, the main thing here is forget the thing about average life expectancy. You can expect to live exactly as long as your karmic perceptions allow you, and that's unpredictable. That's totally insane the way that works. You know, healthy, good, nice people die quickly, and nasty, mean, sick people die old, and that's the way it goes. Yeah?
I don't know where I got this thought, but that somewhere in another realm we know how long we will live, like it is determined, predetermined.
There is, they say there, like Changjia Mingyan is a certain slice of the reality pie, and on in that slice it's fixed at 500 years. Okay, so.
But not this one.
According to scripture. No, not here. Not here. Okay, so that's the first one. Forget average lifespan. Okay. For those of you who can't see it, I'll spell it out, okay? Chi, C-H-I, hyphen Ken, K-Y-E-N. Shintu, S-H-I-N-T-U. Meng, M-A-N-G. La, L-A. Sunken, S-U-N, hyphen K-Y-E-N. Nyung, N-Y-U-N-G. Okay? And I'll ask you to repeat it. Chi Ken? Shintu. Mangla. Sunken. Nyung. One more time. Chiken. Shintu. Mangla. Sunken. Nyung. Okay. Chiken means things that can kill you. Technically, it means factors for death. Okay. But here it means things that can kill you. And you know, I try to make the answer shorter for the homework. And I wanted to cut out the Shintu, but I left it in. Shintu means very. You know, when Tibetans get mad, you hear a lot of Shintu nini, you know. He really is going to, really, really. Shintu. Mangla means many, okay? Extremely many, okay? The things that can kill you are very numerous. La, but Sunken means the things that help keep you alive. Nyung. Nyung means very few. Okay.
Did we miss a la?
The la?
No, in the Tibetan.
Tibet.
I'm sorry. Let's throw one in there. You guys are getting too good. Okay. I was just testing, that's why I left this. Okay. Okay. Nyung means few. Only few. Sunken means things that support life, things that can keep you alive. I mean, the things that can keep you alive are only Cheerios, you know, French fries, sugarless chocolate ice cream. I mean, there are very few things. Honestly, there's very few things that can keep you alive. As a human being, you require feeding and air and water at a certain rate, or you don't last, you know, or you die. And those things are hard to come by. I mean, they require a whole day's work in most countries, okay? Or more than a whole day's work, and then you die. You see what I mean? And in India, I used to see the people crowding the market at 9 o'clock, at 10 o'clock at night. You know, the vegetable market is packed. And you say to the Tibetans, you say, this is weird, you know, don't they get indigestion from eating so late at night? You know, they must not eat till midnight. And they say, that's true. And I say, well, why don't they come earlier? And they say, they can't. And they have come to the market with the money they earned that day to spend it. And they don't get off work till 7 or 8 o'clock. And then they go buy the food for today. And the money is gone by tonight. And that's why the vegetable market's full at 10 o'clock, 9 o'clock at night. And that's why they eat so late. Because they just have enough money to... And the whole effort, if you imagine a whole continent filled with farms and cities and production networks and service networks and transportation networks and delivery networks, and all of this boils down to the sandwich you had tonight. You see, I mean, like thousands of people's effort and all this machinery and all this whole day's work boils down to you must have food in that particular... what do you call it? Configuration within these particular hours, or you die. You see what I mean? So that the things to keep you alive are very rare. They're, like, they're very concerned about Y2K because if the distribution network breaks down for more than 24 hours, the grocery stores in New York for 8 million people are empty. And the supply is that tenuous and that fragile. I mean, the dependency on computers to figure out the best way to ship things and stuff like that has become such that in 24 hours or 48 hours, the store is empty. It's called, in industry, it's your dream to have what they call no stock, you know, like that the cookies come in on the truck that as the last person takes the last one off the shelf because you don't have to pay for storage space. And now computers do it very well. It's called supply, last minute supply. And but if there's a disruption, what's it called?
Just in time.
Yeah, just in time. And we would try to drill it into us. Like, I shouldn't keep a $2 million inventory of diamonds because we could just buy it and ship it out the next day or something like that. And it's a dream of every manufacturer to only have enough that it would run out the next day. And most of our supply is like that. And any major disruption would cause a lot of pain. And that's how few things can keep you alive. Gas. Or, you know, the gas lines. I remember being in India and watching these people fight for gas and saying, we're civilized in America. We don't do that, you know. And then I went home and it was 1975 or something. And people were shooting each other with guns to get gas, you know. And it was weird. So the things that could keep you alive are very hard to come by. They require intense effort by huge teams of people directed in a certain way. And the final outcome of thousands of people's work and tons of fertilizer and dirt and water and everything is this sandwich that you got. And if you don't get delivered food, water, and air in that exact time, at that exact place, in that exact format, you can't eat it. It won't digest and you'll die. And so the things that can keep you alive are really hard to find. The conditions that can keep you alive are very difficult to maintain. And there'll be some kind of disruption maybe in this country and you'll appreciate it. You know, like just if there's a short disruption, 48 hours of food supply, you'll see how difficult it is. You see what I mean? So that's a sunken. Chiken means things that can kill you. Okay? And as we said at the church the other night, the ironic thing is that if you don't die from the inside, meaning if one of your organs doesn't malfunction and kill you, then something outside of you will kill you, and it will very likely be something that you spend a lot of money to buy. You know what I mean? Like, a lot of your life went into getting it, like a nice car, or your house. Like, the staircase in your house will kill you. You know, you wanted a split-level house. You wanted extra space. And, you know, and you wanted to have this extra place to enjoy, and then it kills you. And you wanted to have a better car, and you're still paying it off, and you die in it. You see, it kills you. The windshield kills you. And Buddhism says, look around at the things around you. You know, something in your house. You can get really paranoid. You know, something in your house is ready to kill you, you know. Something you bought. Something you own. I was reading Isadora Duncan's biography, you know.
Yeah.
First, her two kids get killed in a car accident. They fall off a bridge. These are beloved children. And then she spends the rest of her life like just blasted out by it. Comes home one night and finds them dead on the table, you know. And then she has this beautiful, expensive Cartier scarf on, and she gets in a car, and the scarf touches the wheel as it's spinning and gets caught and rips her neck off, you know. Like, it's just a Cartier scarf, you know, and this is like one of the most beautiful women of her time. And the beautiful scarf kills her, you see what I mean? And everybody is killed by something around them, you know. You'll be killed choking on the food that you eat. You'll be killed by a doctor who's trying to save you. You know, you'll be killed by the car that you bought. But if you think about it, the very things that you work so hard to get and the things that you collect so with such effort, one of them will actually, what do you call it? Traitor, what do you call it? Betray you and kill you, you know, and it'll be something around you, you know, it'll be something that you use to live, and it'll kill you, and the very organs that are making you alive now, one of them will
I guess oftentimes it just starts working too well and overcomes the other ones, you know, and it kills you, you know. And like if they get bad, they all have to get bad equally, or one of them gets the upper hand and you die. So in Tibetan medicine, your organs are working not in this beautiful harmony. They're actually competing with each other. And when one gets too strong and the other gets too weak, then they kill it, your body kills you. You see, I mean, the body that you're taking so much time and effort to take care of will betray you and kill you. Okay, so that's a Chikien Shindu monk. And this part of meditation can be a little depressing. Okay, like you don't want to go home, you know. You're looking at the quilt on your bed, you know, like, can I trust you? You know? A lot of people have been killed by their blankets, right? I mean, the modern flammable, you know, blankets, you know. If you've ever had one catch fire, it's really scary. They go up like nothing, you know. Yeah.
Pamoka Rinpoche says, I think, with regard to that step, he says that the three things that keep you alive are your prayers, your past merits, and the kindness of the Buddhas.
Mm-hmm.
With the kindness of the Buddhas, is you referring to whatever teachings you might have received that allow you to accumulate that merit, or?
Yeah, yeah. When they say the kindness of the Buddhas is keeping you alive, it's always teaching. And they taught you virtue, and then you performed it, and then that's protecting you. That's keeping you alive. It has to be like that, you know. It's always like that. Indirect. Because if they could give you life, they would have done it to all the dead people, and they wouldn't be dead. You see what I mean? It's very... you don't have to go to theological school to disprove the existence of a compassionate creator being. Because we are the proof that they don't exist. You know what I mean? Because if they existed and if we were... And if they cared, then we wouldn't be suffering. You see, I mean, you don't have to have a big conference to discuss it. You see, I mean, it's you prove it. You see, I mean, okay, number three. I'll read it for the people that can't see it. The first word is Lu, L-U, Shintu, S-H-I-N-T-U, which now you know what it means. Nyam, N-Y-A-M, Chungwa, C-H, U-N-G-W-A. So please repeat. Lu.
Lu.
Shintu.
Shintu.
Nyam.
Nyam.
Chungwa.
Chungwa.
Lu.
Lu.
Shintu.
Shintu.
Nyam.
Nyam.
Chungwa.
Chungwa.
Okay, Lu means your body. Okay, your body. Shintu means?
Very.
Nyam. Nyam Chungwa means, Nyam Chungwa means fragile. Fragile. Okay. The way they teach this is always the same. They say, you know, take your two fingers here, you know, like that, and put them here, and you know, if there, this is about a half inch of space. If there's not this ineffable air stuff going through here within every 4 or 5 minutes, you die. You know, I mean, that's no like miracle construction. That's a pretty lousy design, I think. You know, you know, there's two little holes here. You know, don't count your mouth. But if there's two little holes, and this stuff has to move through here every 4 or 5 minutes, you know, or you're dead. You know, and it's like a miracle that you've been able to keep it going. You know, it's like they say, think about the odds that there's been no disruption in the air supply yet. That lasted for more than 4 or 5 minutes. Like, your body is really like a disaster waiting to happen. You know what I mean? It's just, it's so breakable. You know, and it depends on such a, even the food you eat has to be so refined. It has to be right temperature. It has to be exactly refined the right way, or you can't digest it. Like, the body is really very picky. And the things that can keep you alive are very few. The fact that you didn't have a disruption in the supply of food to me for more than a few days in your whole life is a miracle. You see what I mean? That you got... They say if you made a pile out of all the sandwiches you've eaten, it would be like as big as... easily bigger than this building. You know what I mean? And somehow, over the course of 40 years, you know, 12,000 days or something, you've been able to get one down to here every single day. You know what I mean? And it's like a miracle. And
And it's such a it's so fragile. The whole system is so bound to failure that you don't get it. Or a small bubble is going the wrong way, you know, somewhere in your body. Or in the case of cancer, I mean, when I really studied cancer, we had gemstones from Sri Lanka, topaz, and we wanted to make them blue. And there is no blue topaz in nature except for little pieces that grow next to radioactive material, which is very rare. And you have to radiate them. So I'm like calling the FTC, Nuclear NRC. And I'm like, is this stuff dangerous or not? Like, we're going to shoot it with neutron radiation, and then we're going to bombard it with electron radiation. And you know, everybody's doing it in the industry, but I just wanted to check in with you because it's my people who have to handle 10,000 pieces a day, and we want to know if it's dangerous or not, you know. And they say, well, we are not ruling on it, you know, meaning they don't want to be responsible, you know. And I said, well, can you give me your private opinion? And he says, well, we're not supposed to say anything except big stuff like nuclear reactors and stuff. And that's low-level radiation, you know. And I said, well, what's that mean? And he says, well, it's giving off gamma rays just the same as a nuclear reactor, but it's very few. So I said, then it's safe. And he says, well, not really. You see, it's because it only takes one to hit one cell in your body to break one chromosome, one piece of your chromosome chain. And then you develop cancer. Then that cell starts to split wrong. So I said, well, then we shouldn't carry it, right? And he says, well, bricks do the same thing. Sunlight does the same thing. When you build a basement, the basement's doing the same thing. You know, he said, that's the way it is. You know, like everything around you, clay is producing gamma radiation, and if you get one unlucky shot from standing next to the wall, now you gotta sit in the middle, okay? And it's just a matter of luck, you know, like some things are more likely to cause it, but it's just totally, you know, a single emission of a single subatomic particle can give you cancer, you know, and your body's just not, you know, they're not made very well like that. That the body's condition is very frighteningly destroyable, okay? And it's like some kind of miracle you've lived this long, okay? And the odds of something happening are very serious. You know, I have friends who are hypochondriacs, and then, you know, I get frustrated with them because they won't go out with me to, you know, have a milkshake because, you know, the place is not purified and all that. But after understanding all this stuff, I realize they're true, they're right. But they can't avoid it anyway. You know, you sit at home, you still got those things hitting you. So that's the condition of our bodies. The body is not made very well. The body is prone to breakdown. It will break down. Okay? And that's Shindu Nyam Chungwa. Okay? Oh, I'm sorry. Chungwa means small, and Nyam means like strength or something here. So Nyam Chungwa means fragile, or it's not very resistant to death-causing things. Okay? Did somebody have a question? No.
Did you shoot the topazes or not?
We did. But we found out there, if you want to know, honestly, we took great care, and we sent them, there's a special ore that only grows in Sri Lanka, and it doesn't get radioactive. And then we brought it to the United States, and we used that, and then every stone we had, we passed it to the nuclear, we actually got the NRC to license a lab, and then we sent them all to the lab, and then we made a big deal in the industry how everything else was dangerous except ours. You know. Okay. Just okay, now they the third principle. What was the third principle, Dan? Nothing but the Dharma can help you. Okay, so now I'll write up those three.
Session 4 continues on the next CD.